is an enormous economic powerhouse. And this product in particular, the 737, which has been in production in one form or another since the 1960s, it's the country's biggest single manufactured export product. So it really is a needle mover in the economy, especially if you consider the enormous supply chain behind it, a lot of which is U.S. focused.
Well, let's talk about going forward now. So we have David Calhoun, who is taking over in mid-January. What do you know about him, and what do you think?
Yeah, you know, he's been on the Boeing board for about 10 years, and he has in the past expressed interest in this job. As a matter of fact, when the previous CEO was striving to get it, Dave Calhoun had put his hat in the ring as well. You know, he's got a background that's it touches upon aerospace here and there, GE aircraft engines, but a lot of it at GE in general, infrastructure and other units during the Jack Welch era. A lot of background in private equity, money management, that kind of thing. Not really what you call core to aerospace engineering and restoring the company to, you know, what it originally was in terms of having managers who came from that aircraft background, either in terms of program management or engineering or anything like that.
Is that a problem?
Having said, well, you know, that gets to the big question of how long he's staying for. As a short-term stabilizer, he's a really good choice. He's deeply respected by a lot of people. He's got a great external presence. He'll be a good diplomat, which is perhaps what they need right now after the recent missteps. But in terms of somebody who changes the way the company operates and, well, gets relations between the commercial aircraft unit in Seattle and corporate headquarters in Chicago back on track, he's probably not the right choice for that.
One of the fundamental problems that many people see as being exposed here is that regulators, a lot of the responsibility for certifying aircraft came out of the hands of regulators and were actually put in the hands of a company like Boeing. Is it up to Boeing and David Calhoun to fix that or address that problem? Or does that also rest on lawmakers and others?
Yeah, you know, so much does come down to Washington, the FAA, Congress. And I think it needs to be part of a broader conversation. We've had this mantra of deregulate, deregulate, deregulate. And of course, in the Reagan era, that did a lot of good. But there are some cases, certainly this one comes to mind, where things might have gone a bit too far. But in order to successfully put government back in control in situations like this, resources need to be provided. And of course, that happens at the congressional level.
Richard Abulafia, aerospace analyst and vice president of the consulting firm Teal Group. Thanks so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
At the beginning of this year, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was facing a lot of questions. Could she lead the Democrats? How would she handle President Trump? In 2019, there have been intra-party fights, a government shutdown, skirmishes with the Republicans, and of course, impeachment. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales talked to Democrats about Pelosi's return to Speaker of the House.
It wasn't that long ago that House Democrats didn't know who would lead them. They were warring over the speakership just days after the 2018 midterm elections handed them back the majority. But Nancy Pelosi was certain of her fate.
I have overwhelming support in my caucus to be Speaker of the House.
But moderates in her party weren't so sure. Representative Dean Phillips of Minnesota was part of a wave of new members who flipped districts that Trump won in 2016, and he wasn't a Pelosi fan initially.
I came here intending to find new leadership.
But he was persuaded to vote for Pelosi and now calls it one of the most meaningful decisions in his political career.
Thank goodness that we have Nancy Pelosi speaking for the House of Representatives, because I do not think there is a better, more qualified, more principled, and more effective person for these times and these circumstances than she.
Massachusetts Representative Seth Moulton was one of the most public critics who tried to elect someone else as Speaker, but he also fell in line and now joins others heaping on the praise.
She kept the party together through an incredibly contentious and difficult time.
Her longtime allies on Capitol Hill agree. Debbie Dingell of Michigan says Pelosi knows how to lead a rambunctious group of lawmakers.
She took up one of the most diverse caucuses in the history of this country, people with lots of intense, strong, emotional passions, different thoughts, and brought us together.
Another reason House Democrats are united behind Pelosi is how she's handled Trump. Here's Representative Jan Schakowsky of Illinois.
The one person, course, the only woman, too, to stand up in the Oval Office and point to the President of the United States and take him to task.
Speaker Pelosi met one of her biggest challenges as calls for impeachment from within her caucus grew. Many on the left wanted action after special counsel Robert Mueller found instances the president obstructed an investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. But Pelosi strongly resisted, saying impeachment needed to have support from Republicans and the public.
I don't think there's anything more divisive we can do than to impeach a president of the United States.
But that changed when a whistleblower said the president was pressuring Ukraine to investigate a political rival in exchange for congressionally approved military aid. Once Pelosi got on board with impeachment, she led her caucus through a contentious process. But that wasn't all. She also helped negotiate a major trade deal and a massive bipartisan spending package. Here's Schakowsky again.
I think that she runs circles as a strategist around pretty much everybody.
Even though impeachment is what helped bring her caucus together, she's rejected that's what her legacy will be. Pelosi at a recent CNN town hall stressed how she got a major health care bill passed.
No, I want to be remembered as part of the Affordable Care Act.
Pelosi doesn't seem worried about her legacy. She has her hands full keeping her caucus together as they head into another partisan national election in 2020. How she handles that will determine whether she'll remain speaker. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, Washington.
So every year around Christmas time in Seattle, Neil Koshy-Meyer gets on stage and performs.
Yeah, not Christmas songs, though, not Yuletide jingles, but instead this.
You're not going to believe this, but that was one word from Finnegan's Wake, that work of experimental fiction by James Joyce. And Neil Koshy-Meyer is not only performing Joyce's words, he is attempting to memorize the entire book.
Yeah, he says it's going to take him 17 years to do it, which coincidentally is the same amount of time it took James Joyce to write the book. Neil said it all started when he read that first word, which comes on the very first page.
It was like one thing led to another. It's like if you give a mouse a cookie, kind of. It's like a little drum solo that I can do anytime I feel like it.
As you might imagine, it has not been easy.
But that has not stopped Neil, who says you can't really think of Finnegan's Wake as a normal book. You have to think of it kind of the way we think of music.
It can be thoroughly enjoyed, delightfully thoroughly enjoyed, without understanding a bit of what's going on in it. I mean, there is something going on. But I think you can read through the whole book, and if you decide I'm not going to worry about understanding it, the music of it and the fun of it is there anyway.
But we asked Neil to prove that.
And spoke she to the dower in her petty Parusian, mark thou once, why do I am a look like a possum porter piece? And that was how the skirt mishies began.
Neil memorized and recited chapter 6 this year. He's on track to have all of Finnegan's Wake memorized by the year 2030.
Have you heard of one Humpty Dumpty? How he fell with a rock?
And you could catch Neil performing chapter 7 of Finnegan's Wake next Christmas in Seattle.
By the butt of the magazine wall. By the magazine wall. Hump helmet and all. He was one time our king of the castle. Now he's kicked around like a rotten old parsnip. And from Green Street he'll be sent by order of his worship to the penal jail of Mount Joy.
This is NPR News.
Morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Maybe this is a bad admission for a former English major, but I thought he was speaking Klingon. Well, coming up on Morning Edition on WPR, for the first time in two decades, the number of men who use tobacco is decreasing. That's according to the World Health Organization. In about 20 minutes, we'll hear more about the significance of that downward trend.
Celebrate the season with special programs on Wisconsin Public Radio all this month. Enjoy festive music from Simply Folk, Christmas music from the Morehouse and Spelman Glee Clubs, and the annual New Year's Concert from Vienna. Find a complete schedule of holiday programs at wpr.org/holidays.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Security Health Plan, dedicated to providing neighborly customer service, and health plans for large and small Wisconsin employers. Full details about health plans are at securityhealth.org.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring rollicking buckaroo pepper jam. Although meant for use as a glaze on meat or fish, as a stir-fry base, or with crackers and cream cheese, the possibilities are endless. The market is open Saturdays from 10 until 2 in the Kenosha Masonic Center.
Partly sunny in the south today, cloudy in central and northern Wisconsin with some wintry mix possible today and tonight. Highs from the mid-30s to the mid-40s. Upper 40s, rather. For Wednesday, patchy fog in the morning, then mostly cloudy. Some drizzle and freezing drizzle is possible for the central and northern parts of the state. Highs from the upper 30s to the upper 40s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Americans for the Arts, committed to transforming America's communities through the arts and arts education, supporting the nonprofit arts industry, which employs 4.6 million people nationwide. Learn more at americansforthearts.org. From the law firm Cooley LLP, with offices in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. And from People for the American Way, committed to protecting the right to vote, fighting for equality, defending free expression, and building the bench of progressive leaders. More at pfaw.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. A group of women got together at a coffee shop outside of Seattle. They were there to talk about a book about Christian living. But they realized they had something in common, family members who had struggled with addiction. Anna Boyko-Wyrock of the podcast Finding Fixes brought us the story.
Andrea Chapel-Homan used to be a pastor at a big church. When her son Harrison was in ninth grade, he got kicked out of a Christian school for bringing in tequila. Chapel-Homan started homeschooling him part-time, but as a pastor, having a son struggling with drugs and alcohol didn't look good for her church.
There's the crazy that people that don't have an addict just don't understand.
So she resigned. Over the next few years, her son's addiction got worse. Chapel-Homan says her friends and faith community pulled away at the worst time.
There's high highs where it looks like, oh, they're better because they're pretending really well. And so you fast forward and think, oh, we're turned a corner. It's going to be better. And then the next, within hours, there's a crash because they're using again. And you're just heartbroken.
Chapel-Homan says she was exhausted.
I would be on my hardwood floor, on my arm, just sobbing and crying out and just praying, Jesus, please help me. Jesus, please help me.
At this point, her son was 18 and homeless. So she wrote a book about leading a Christian life called The Story Lives. It was published in 2012, and Chapel-Homan organized a book club to talk about her book. They met at a coffee shop, and six women showed up.
The first chapter is about everyone has a story. And so we went around and told our stories.
Chapel-Homan went first.
Part of my story is that my son Harrison started drinking at age 11, got in trouble with the law, started smoking pot, started using heroin, and he's on the street, and I'm praying for him daily.
She says the other book club members could relate.
Somebody else said, yeah, me too. Then pretty soon I was like, well, yeah, me three and me four.
Four of the six women were mothers of someone addicted to heroin. A fifth had two brothers who had a substance use disorder.
If it weren't so serious, it was almost funny that we were all there together. What were the odds?
Book club member Terry Bowman.
We felt it was truly God that brought us all together to process through this.
Bowman's son was addicted to heroin and had moved in with her. Bowman says she was afraid and overwhelmed.
What will happen tonight? What will happen tomorrow? Will it get worse? Will it get better? Where's he going to go? Will he come home? will he ever leave our house?
But Bowman found she wasn't alone. She was surrounded by others who'd been down this path before, like Pastor Schappelhoman.
We were these people who had done our best to bring up these children in a safe environment, taking them to church, putting them in Christian school. And suddenly, one day you wake up and your child is the opposite of anything you'd ever imagined, has become a criminal, an addict, a liar, a thief. And so our shared experience in so many ways was, how did we get here?
The book club was a rare place Schappelhoman and the other women could cry, laugh, and talk about their challenges, even more than they talked about the book. Therapist and social worker Laura Okoloko works with families of those struggling with substance use.
You, the concerned loved one, you matter. And we need you to sustain this effort so that you don't get burnt out and want nothing to do with this person anymore, because they need you.
The popular myths about cutting ties with addicted loved ones did not work for Pastor Schappelhoman either.
The advice of the world was very distressing. Kick him out. He needs to just find bottom. Bottom for heroin is death, I think. You need to do this. You need to do that. But not, how are you doing? How can I help you?
That's why, as the book club evolved, they made a rule. Give support, but no advice. In summer 2013, the women moved their meetings to Schappelhoman's house. Schappelhoman says the group continued to embrace their faith.
We would always put our hope in that our lives could still be meaningful, that Jesus and God was still good, and we had a support group, that if something went wrong, we were all just a phone call and a prayer on the phone away from each other.
And eventually, the chaos in some of the families subsided. Pastor Schappelhoman's son, Harrison, got off heroin using the medication Suboxone. Terry Bowman's son is in recovery, too, with the help of methadone. That's another thing about their community. People on medication-assisted treatment are sometimes not welcome in Christian or secular recovery programs, but not so in this group. Last year, the book club turned support group turned dinner club became a church. That was 5 years after the first book club meeting.
All right, let's pray. Lord Jesus, thank you for today.
Schappelhoman is the pastor here. She welcomes the community and leads them in prayer and song. Kai Bird comes here with her daughter, who's in recovery from addiction, because she says she feels at peace.
There is nothing more that somebody could give me, because one of the things that you look for when you have someone who is out there in drugs is you just want some peace of mind.
Schappelhoman's son, Harrison, is now an adult. It was his idea to start the church to help people with addiction in their families.
I always used to tell my mom, how are we supposed to get better if you aren't better? And I was like, please don't take that as an insult. I know I'm a lot worse than you guys are, but this is a family disease.
Looking back, Pastor Schappelhoman says the church isn't immune from experiencing the opioid epidemic. Now, she's leading the kind of church she wishes her family had during those hard times.
I'm excited that we were chosen for this journey by God, because if there's no one like us who's gone through, and how can we be the hope and the help for others?
The new church is a place of faith and support. It's called True Hope Community. For NPR News, I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock in Seattle.
That story came to us from Finding Fixes. It's a podcast about solutions to the opioid epidemic. This is NPR News.
If you're on Facebook, you've probably seen friends ask for donations to a special cause for their birthday. It's been good business for charities, but some users find the constant appeals annoying.
Don't hit me up with in lieu of presents. Who buys all their Facebook friends a birthday present? That's arrogant.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Hear all the day's news on All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on WPI.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Morning Edition on WPR. We've got news from NPR and WPR up next. In state news, the leader of Wisconsin's Senate Democrats says addressing Wisconsin's so-called dark store loophole will be on lawmakers' agenda in 2020.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. China, South Korea, and Japan say they'll work together to encourage dialogue between North Korea and the United States. NPR's Emily Fang reports the push for negotiations come amid fears North Korea could conduct an intercontinental missile test as relations with the U.S. reach a stalemate.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in pledged cooperation with China and Japan towards peace on the Korean Peninsula as tensions between the U.S. and North Korea escalate. North Korea has hinted it might soon test a nuclear-tipped missile capable of reaching U.S. shores, promising a, quote, Christmas gift should there be no progress towards removing U.S.-backed sanctions.
NPR's Emily Fang reporting. Five children are among the latest casualties of a week-long offensive by Syrian government forces backed by Russia. The BBC's Sebastian Usher reports the attack took place in the rebel-held province of Idlib.
An airstrike hit a school where locals were taking refuge from the onslaught that's been unleashed in the past week. At least eight people are reported to have been killed. Activists say that more than 80 civilians have died in the air and ground bombardments over the past few days. Pictures from the region in and around the city of Marat al-Numan show a level of devastation that became horribly familiar during the height of the Syrian war.
The BBC's Sebastian Usher reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 18 points. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. The leader of Wisconsin Senate Democrats says she hopes a plan to address Wisconsin's so-called dark store loophole will be on lawmakers' agenda in 2020. The proposal would change how empty stores are factored into property tax bills for other businesses. Current law allows big box stores to use the value of vacant former stores to lower their own property taxes. Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling of La Crosse says Democrats and Republicans should come together to vote on the plan.
Communities, local units of government continue to find it expensive and costly in lawsuits and reassessments on that one. That feels like we could find some common ground on that one.
The bill has a bipartisan list of co-sponsors in the Senate and Assembly, but it has yet to be scheduled for a public hearing in this legislative session. A similar bill died last session. Giving and receiving a secret Santa gift from a coworker or friend can be a fun way to celebrate the holidays, but participating in a secret sister gift exchange with friends online is illegal. Corrine Hess has details.
The exchange became popular in 2015 through Facebook, promising participants they could receive up to 36 gifts in exchange for sending one $10 gift. Users are encouraged to invite others to participate in the gift exchange. They were promised they would receive information on where to mail the gifts. Jim Temmer heads Wisconsin's Better Business Bureau. He says the exchange is a pyramid scheme. Pyramid schemes are illegal in the United States and Canada.
By the time most people have paid or sent a gift, there aren't enough people being recruited to send them anything.
The Better Business Bureau says to ignore the Facebook posts and report it on the social media site. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Aaron Jones rushed for 2 second-half touchdowns. Za'Darius Smith had 5 tackles for loss, and the Green Bay Packers became the NFC North champions by beating the Minnesota Vikings 23-10. The Packers are 12-3 and made Matt LaFleur the 10th rookie coach in NFL history to reach 12 victories by winning for the first time in 4 tries at Minnesota's U.S. Bank Stadium. The Vikings led 10-9 at halftime after 3 first-half turnovers by the Packers, but they were dominated after that to drop their record to 10-5. Vikings quarterback Kirk Cousins threw an interception and was sacked 5 times. Minnesota will be the 6th seed in the NFC playoffs. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Duolingo, a language app whose mission is to make language learning fun and accessible to the world. With lessons in more than 30 languages, including French, Spanish, and Chinese, available in the App Store or at Duolingo.com. And from TIAA, committed to the idea that while most things in life run out, from clean shirts in the morning to a favorite dessert at night, lifetime income in retirement shouldn't. Learn more at TIAA.org/neverrunout.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. A six-year-old girl in South London was writing Christmas cards to the kids in her class when she found a bizarre message written inside one of the cards. It said in part, "We are foreign prisoners forced to work against our will. Please help us." The card was made in China, and the message appeared to be written by a factory worker. NPR's Frank Langfitt is watching all of this from London. Hey, Frank.
Hi, Noel.
So what do we know about what happened here?
Well, the girl, whose name is Florence Whitcomb, I believe, was opening this up to write to a friend. And inside the note also said, and it was written, in caps, it said, please notify Human Rights Organization and please contact Peter Humphrey. Now, Peter Humphrey lives in Greater London. He was a corporate fraud investigator who served time in this exact prison in Qingpu, a Shanghai suburb. Now, Humphrey was eventually released in 2015, and the family reached out to Humphrey, who wrote about it in the Sunday Times. Humphrey used to be a Reuters reporter. The card was sold by the British supermarket chain Tesco. Tesco has said they're suspending any orders on these cards and are investigating.
So in the meantime, the Chinese Foreign Ministry says this is a hoax. They say it's just not true. Are they offering any evidence for that claim?
Not yet that I've seen, but the Chinese company that made the cards is emphatic that it never contracted with this prison outside of Shanghai, and saying the charge of using forced labor is completely fabricated. Now, the Foreign Ministry actually, this is very curious, Noel, actually blames Humphrey personally.
The journalist.
And says that suggests that he's behind all of this. Now, there's a past here. The Chinese government said Humphrey was imprisoned for illegally collecting citizens' information. I've talked to Humphrey on the phone. He says that charge was bogus. It was never heard in court. And he actually says that he recognizes the handwriting of the card as a prisoner that he knew when he was in the prison. Now, I asked him about the Foreign Ministry's claim that he's behind this, and Humphrey says this is just a typical kind of response that the government uses to any accusations about human rights abuses.
This is the kind of answer you always get. You get a lie. You get a complete lie in response. The one thing about this message that is a little bit different, maybe, is it's a very, very personal attack on me, accusing me of fabricating this story. But, you know, I didn't invent a little girl in South London and her father, who I've never known in my life. And I didn't invent the message that they handed to me. So it's absolutely ridiculous.
Okay, that was Peter Humphrey. Frank, you were based in Shanghai for 5 years.
Yes.
Did you ever come across stories like this?
Yeah, it's actually not all that uncommon. These sorts of messages tend to surface in Chinese products every few years. Back in 2012, there was a woman in Oregon who discovered an account of torture in Halloween decorations that were made in China. Back in 2014, I interviewed an American sociology professor. His name's Stuart Foster. He'd served time for theft, and I talked to him after he got out from jail. And he said he'd been forced to assemble Christmas lights in a jail in Guangdong province. His quota was 3,000 lights, I think, a day. And he said the prisoners who didn't meet quotas were beaten. This is what he told me.
There was one particular leader during the month of July that was particularly sadistic. Actually, he had braided a few of the Christmas light cords together, and he would come up behind inmates that were working slow and slash them across the back.
Now, Foster told me that he remembered one inmate being whipped, and this inmate was mentally slow, Foster thought, and he could actually see the welts form on his back after he was struck. And after I did that story, Noel, I've received messages on Facebook and elsewhere from other former inmates saying that they've made Christmas ornaments and things like that in Chinese prisons.
Gosh, this all sounds outrageous. What do human rights groups say about what's going on there?
They say that this is kind of standard operating procedure in a lot of prisons in China. Manufacturing and sort of providing labor is big business. You can find advertisements online for this. And Human Rights Watch estimates there could be millions working at this. And I was talking to Yachio Wong. She's a researcher with Human Rights Watch, and this is how she put it.
According to Chinese law, that prisoners, as long as you have the ability to labor, you have to labor. So, you know, forced labor is a given in prison in China.
In the couple seconds we have left, there are labor laws in China, right?
There are, but what Yachio Wong says is the prison system is opaque and they don't follow them.
NPR's Frank Langfitt in London. Frank, thank you.
You're very welcome, Noel.
Here's a stat. 4 out of 5 smokers around the world are male. But a new report finds that for the first time in 2 decades, the number of men using tobacco is decreasing. NPR's Ping Huang tells us what's going on.
If you're buying a pack of Derby cigarettes in Brazil, about 75% of the cost is taxes. The quit hotline is printed on the pack, along with pictures of sickness and death. Tobacco researcher Stella Bialis describes a few.
Like a kid coughing to explain the harms of secondhand smoke. They'll have somebody clutching their chest, looking like they're having a heart attack. They have one that has a mouth cancer, so they have like this diseased mouth.
Bialis is now at the University of California, San Francisco, but she's originally from Rio de Janeiro. She says fewer people today are using tobacco, and she says government policies have helped, like those warnings on cigarette packs and strict bans on advertising. The new smoking numbers come from a World Health Organization report. The number of men using tobacco peaked in 2018 at around 1.1 billion. Rudiger Krech with the WHO says for the first time in 20 years, those numbers are starting to fall.
Fewer males using tobacco products means fewer people will suffer the avoidable pain and death that they cause.
The report focuses on men because some 40% of men worldwide smoke or chew, but only 10% of women do. Jeffrey Fong studies tobacco use at the University of Waterloo in Canada. He says it's the number one cause of preventable disease and death. Every year, 8 million people die from using tobacco or breathing secondhand smoke. Fong celebrates the decrease in smokers, but he says tobacco is still a huge public health problem.
Tobacco use isn't like malaria or polio. It is a corporate-born epidemic.
Fong says the tobacco industry is fighting hard to keep their customers and profits. The other big obstacle is social norms. People smoke during work breaks or to relax with friends. Bialis in San Francisco says habits are slow to change, but strong policies help. She says that growing up in Rio,
I remember when we could smoke in the plane and it could smoke in restaurants and we could smoke in classrooms even.
Now, with indoor smoking banned in many countries, that's something her son, who's 20 years old, can't even imagine. Ping Huang, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening today. It's 8:42 now. Coming up, a classic of American literature is coming to the screen in yet another version. In about 9 minutes, actress Saoirse Ronan discusses her role in the new movie Little Women with NPR's Noel King.
Memes are constantly reposted, of course, but when companies do it, meme makers might not be so happy.
It's a little bit different when somebody who's making money off of posting memes starts collecting those and using them for their own purposes and their own financial gain.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, advertising with memes, next time on Marketplace.
Hear Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show giveaways, and logoed business gifts. More about 4imprint's dedication to customer satisfaction is at 4imprint.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Racine County Public Works has announced the 2020 reservation schedule for picnic areas and camping. Online reservations will open at 2 p.m. on January 2nd. For more info, visit realracine.com.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and here are a couple stories this morning. Christmas Eve is here, and that means millions around the globe are watching Santa's journey in real time. NORAD tracks Santa is back, this time with updated technology and even mobile apps for real-time updates on St. Nick's progress. People can also check it by calling 1-877-HI-NORAD to get Santa's whereabouts. The operation has become its own holiday tradition. For 64 years, NORAD, as the U.S.-Canadian Air Defense Command is known, and its predecessors have kept close watch on Santa's journey to assure anxious children and adults that he's on his way. We think Santa's in good shape, but O'Hare Airport, not so much. The Federal Aviation Administration grounded all flights at Chicago's O'Hare and Midway airports this morning as dense fog shrouded the region. The fog is not expected to lift quickly, but even if it does, it could still cause a chain reaction of delays and missed connections on one of the busiest travel days of the holiday season. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant-making and social investing. More at kresge.org. From the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And from the Arcus Foundation, dedicated to the idea that people can live in harmony with one another and the natural world.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm David Green. Here at Morning Edition, we have been recognizing the end of a decade by asking actors, authors, musicians, and others about their favorites from the 2010s.
Hello, this is Iggy Pop. I want to choose Sweet Leaf of the North by Mick Artistic's Ego Trip.
And then there was this pick from the chef Samin Nosrat.
For me, one of the most powerful pieces of art that I've consumed is the novel Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
Okay, but there has been some doubt about whether this actually is the end of the decade, including doubts from you, our listeners. And so Rachel Martin spoke to Sandy Duncan, the managing editor of the Farmer's Almanac. She asked Sandy if this is the end of the decade.
Is it? It feels like a big deal, 2019 to 2020. Why is there such a debate about whether or not this is the end of the decade?
You know, it's really interesting, but I hate to tell you, it's not.
It's not?
Actually, no. We ran a story several years ago. In fact, you know, remember the big celebration in 1999, people thought that the new millennial was going to start the next year. But really, a decade begins actually with the year ending in the numeral one. There was never a year zero. So when we started counting time way back when, it goes one through 10. So a decade is 10 years. So in actuality, the next decade won't start until January 1st, 2021.
So does it drive you crazy? I mean, I feel like I hear these stories at the end of every, you know, a year that ends with a nine, that, oh, we're at the end of the decade, and so let's do these big retrospectives. Are you just like screaming into the wind when you hear that?
Well, it is. You know, it's one of those things where it's numbers and it kind of gets confusing. I mean, kind of like when you count, you know, how old is your child before the age of one, you kind of count those months. But then really what is the end of the decade is after he turns 10 or she turns 10. So here at the Farmer's Almanac, we really try to be a little more astronomically oriented. And it's kind of confusing and definitely is worth a conversation. But it's kind of fun to look back and celebrate, you know, 2020, no matter what, if you're counting as a new decade or not.
It's funny. Is there something about it just being like, you know, just making that flip? It's not just one placeholder that changes in the numbers. It's two. And that feels significant to us. But you're telling me that it's just meaningless.
Well, it's not meaningless. I mean, 2020 is going to be an interesting year. It's 20 years since 2000 when everybody was afraid that the world was going to end and all the computers were going
right
to stop working.
So we survived.
But yeah, there's one more year to celebrate this decade.
I mean, when we talk about decades, when we think about, oh, what it was like in the 60s, what it was like in the 70s. I mean, when we say the 70s, culturally, we think of the year 1970 through 1979.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those confusing things. I mean, when the Almanacs celebrated our 200th anniversary, we started printing in 1818, and yet the 2017 was our 200th edition. It's one of these mathematical conundrums that people can argue about until they're blue in the face. And it's, you know, even more confusing when you look at the 2000s. I mean, what do you call the decades of the 20s? I guess it's the 20s, but is that the 1920s or the 2020s? So it's one of those fun things that you can argue about until next, the new decade, which starts on January 1st, 2021.
All right, the party keeps going. Sandy Duncan, managing editor at the Farmer's Almanac. Sandy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The This is NPR News.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to WPR today. Coming up in 10 minutes, a Christmas tradition, a festival of nine lessons and carols. The service will be live from the chapel of King's College in Cambridge, England. It's heard by millions around the world. Music is provided by the King's College Choir, and members of the college, choir, and community provide the readings. A festival of nine lessons and carols beginning at 9 here on WPR.
I'm Gregory Berg, encouraging you to subscribe to the new Morning Show podcast, which can be found on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts, to receive a different morning show 7 days a week. Remember to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
Takes you on a journey through the issues and keeps you informed about all the campaigns. Listen every day from NPR News.
In sports, how about those Packers? They became the NFC North champions by beating the Minnesota Vikings 23-10. The Packers are 12-3. Green Bay plays the Detroit Lions on Sunday. Well, WPR has music and special programs for you over the holidays, including Christmas at Luther College at noon today. At 1, NPR's Corva Coleman hosts Christmas with the Morehouse and Spelman Glee Clubs. Two of the most prestigious historically black institutions in the nation get together to present a joyous celebration of spirituals and carols. And then at 2, it's Hanukkah Lights 2019, an annual NPR favorite with brand new Hanukkah stories hosted by Susan Stamberg.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. Louisa May Alcott's book, Little Women, is 150 years old. It should feel ancient, but somehow it doesn't. Somehow it holds up. There have been many adaptations, and now there's a new movie version out on Christmas Day, directed by Greta Gerwig. The book is about four sisters, Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy, who are growing up during the Civil War. Their father has gone off to fight for the Union Army, and they're at home with their mother, Marmee. One of the sisters, Jo, refuses to conform. She refuses to act like a lady. She wears pants instead of dresses. She doesn't want to get married. She wants to make a living as a writer, which is a tough thing to pull off in a time where women don't really earn their own money. The Irish actress Saoirse Ronan plays Jo in the movie, and she says that playing Jo taught her to loosen up a little.
I really am a perfectionist, and just physically to be able to sort of mess up this character a bit was really great for me, to be so sort of animated, to gesticulate as much as I did, to shout, to make like sort of odd facial expressions and be as expressive as I wanted to and not worry about it. I don't think I really had the confidence to do that before.
I was struck when I was watching this movie by how physical it is. Jo is always running someplace. She is always jumping on someone. People are like hugging, like thrusting to themselves into each other's arms. Yes. Oh my goodness. And like you say, making funny faces and like throwing their hands around in the air. In the book, were the girls that physical, or did you say they were girls and we know that they were very close, and so there would have been all of this running and hugging and all of that? Where did that come from?
See, this is the myth, which is, it's great we're kind of getting rid of it, is that girls are not sort of poised or put together or anything like that. They're so similar to the way boys are, I think, when they're in this sort of pack. And that's the way I've always been with my girlfriends. And so that's a very natural dynamic, I think, for girls to have, especially when they're sisters.
We don't necessarily think of Little Women this way, but a lot of this book, it is about money. And it is about the way that women operate in the world 150 years ago, when they could not, for the most part, go out and make their own money. They're totally dependent on whomever they marry or their fathers.
Yeah, and it's amazing, the speech that Flo has, that amazing speech where she says...
Oh, can we talk about this? This is Jo's sister, Amy. Jo is baffled by why Amy wants to marry rich. Jo wants to go out and be a writer. And she thinks of Amy as this weird creature who just seems concerned with being pretty and standing up straight and painting. So talk about that moment in the movie. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, well, there's this scene that she has, and she talks about how no matter how great she wants to be as an artist, and she does want to be the best. I love that she has that line where she says, I want to be the best or I want to be nothing.
Yeah.
But she's like, this is something that I have to consider. You know, any material that I produce, any children that I produce, they don't belong to me. So I need to marry well.
And as a woman, there's no way for me to make my own money. Not enough to earn a living or to support my family. And if I had my own money, which I don't, that money would belong to my husband the moment we got married. And if we had children, they would be his, not mine. They would be his property. So don't sit there and tell me that marriage isn't an economic proposition, because it is.
What I love about Little Women and what I love about all the girls is that, especially with Amy and Meg, they take control of their destiny in a different way to Jo. And I think Jo is obviously a very relatable woman to people now, and there's a lot of girls out there that are very similar to Jo March. But I think it's also just as empowering and just as interesting to see a character like Amy that's like, no, I'm gonna marry and I'm gonna make it work for me, but I'm also gonna do all these other things too.
Do you think about that in your own life at all? I mean, you're 25?
Yeah.
So you came of age at a time, really, when it seemed like women could do anything. When you look back at these characters and think of the extraordinarily small odds of a woman being able to take care of herself, being able to make a living, what goes through your mind? Do you feel bad for them? Do you think, well, maybe it was easier back then?
I don't think so. I think the only people that I really envy, I think, are kids because they have the best of everything. They don't have any responsibilities yet and they can just be silly all the time. But I think, you know, in this day and age for men and women, there is a lot of pressure to not only like get a job like our parents did, but like find your career and like really figure out who you are and to be your authentic self 100% of the time. But I also think that what has come with that is agency and independence, and they can flourish, you know, maybe in a way that women weren't given the opportunity to back then, you know. I'd imagine like for someone like Louisa, there must have been so much frustration that they were like, yes, I know I can be really great, but there's so many battles that you sort of have to face as well as just doing your job, you know. And I think that's something that people still face now, definitely.
How do you figure that a book that's 150 years old still feels completely resonant in 2019? Was it Louisa May Alcott being that good a writer? Or is there something eternal about what she was writing?
Yeah, I think there was something very timeless about what she wrote about, which is somebody's pursuit of their destiny. And I think on top of that as well, like, this is a story about art and commerce, but it's also really sort of shining a light on childhood memories and how we kind of are so desperate to hold on to them. And I think that there's, you know, there is a sort of sadness that comes with getting older and leaving that behind. And I think with Little Women, it's a story about so many things, but certainly for Jo and the girls, there's moments near the end of the movie where they realise that, like, that lovely little bubble that they were in for years that Marmee created for them kind of isn't there anymore. And that's just kind of part of life.
Saoirse Ronan, thank you so much for taking the time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green.
I'm Melissa Ingalls. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. To follow developments throughout the day, visit WPR.org. There you can check out statewide reports from WPR's award-winning news team, plus national and global headlines from NPR.
Support for WPR comes from Boardman Clark, a Wisconsin law firm serving businesses, communities, and individuals. Attorneys committed to listening with intent so clients can act with conviction and chart the best path forward. BoardmanClark.com.
Support comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. With the holidays approaching, these can be difficult times. If you are struggling, having a bad day, or need someone to listen, text HOPELINE to 741-741 for free crisis counseling 24/7.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR.